Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm Louisa. I'm the host. Joining me today is author of Happy Gut, Dr. Vincent Pedre. Dr. Pedre is a board-certified internist and gastroenterologist. Now, we know that the gut has many issues. First of all, we know that gut issues are the root cause of chronic illnesses for millions of people. But what is fundamentally driving these imbalances? I'm often asking myself this very question. Poor gut health can be the result of food sensitivities, poor diet, antibiotics, toxin exposure, infection, and other insults that disrupt the microbiome. Today on the Neuro Experience Podcast, Dr. Vincent Pedre is going to discuss the impact of chronic stress on the gut. And we're really going to learn more of the philosophy of gut health. This is something that I don't think about. You know, how does spirituality play on our gut, which then plays on our gut-brain axis, which then plays on our thoughts, which lead to chronic disease states? This is an area that I've been wanting to delve into for so long. And Dr. Pedre believes that the gut is the gateway to wellness. And he's actually helped thousands of people around the world resolve their gut-related health issues. And he's done this through his best-selling book, which is Happy Gut, the cleansing program to help you lose weight, gain energy, and eliminate pain. So I hope you get just as much out of this as I did. Without further delay, let's get into the episode. Before we move further, I just want to let everybody know that the Neuro Experience is exclusively partnered with Momentous Supplements. I get asked often, actually daily, Louisa, I went and got my blood results done and it turns out that I'm low in vitamin D, or it turns out I'm low in iron, or this or that, or hey Louisa, how do I just upgrade my mental performance? I always turn people to Momentous Supplements because they are by far the best supplements on the market. And I've actually partnered with them for many reasons. One, they ship internationally. So for all of you people listening in Australia, you can get your hands on these supplements. But two, Momentous Supplements are by far the best quality on the market. They are triple certified by governing bodies. The purity that you buy is next to none. Head on over to livemomentous.com/neuro. You're going to see my cognitive bundle. Okay. This includes things such as alpha GPC. This is what's going to help you upgrade your focus and concentration. You're going to have creatine in there. No matter what age you are, obviously 18 and above, you should be supplementing with creatine at minimum 5 grams a day. I've got my omega-3 fatty acids, or the EPA DHA, listed on there as well. And you guys can get 15% off. Just go to livemomentous.com/neuro to receive 15% off all of the Momentous supplements. A huge thank you to our sponsor, Athletic Greens. Athletic Greens has a product called AG1, and it's a vitamin mineral probiotic drink that covers all of your foundational nutritional needs. I've been taking AG1 since around 2014, and this was during my triathlon days when I needed to bank on my nutrition more so than ever. That's why I'm so delighted that they're sponsoring the podcast. The reason I started taking Athletic Greens is fundamentally for my gut microbiome. You see, our gut is extremely important. It's populated by gut microbiota that communicate with the brain and the immune system and basically all of the biological systems of our body. It's so imperative that we are taking care of our microbiotic health. AG1 contains a number of adaptogens, vitamins, minerals, and that enables us to make sure that we are getting our foundational nutritional needs. If you'd like to try AG1, you can go to athleticgreens.com/neuro, and they'll give you 5 free travel packs that make it easy for you to mix it on the road, in the car, on the plane. They'll also give you a 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2. That is athleticgreens.com/neuro to get 5 free travel packs and a year supply worth of D3 and K2. Dr. Pedre, welcome to the Neuro Experience Podcast.
It's such a pleasure to be here and to be here in person.
I know, right? I'm so happy that this was, because you've got your office here in Midtown.
I have my office here in Midtown East.
Yeah. Nice. But you've brought out a book and you're doing so many other things other than doing the regular patient doctor relationship. You're now out educating the world.
I'm one to the many. And it's really part of my mission to, leave a legacy, but also have an impact beyond the one-to-one experience of working with me, because I realized that I can only see a certain number of people. And what I want to do and the way I want to impact the world is much greater than that. And that's what led me actually to write my first book, Happy Gut. And then, you know, it's almost like you forget how difficult the first baby was. And then you decide, oh, I'm going to have another baby.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, here is my second book, The Gut Smart Protocol.
Yeah. And that's what I want to talk about, because right now, and you mentioned this offline, that around 11% of the world suffers from IBS. Is that a low number or is that a high number?
I mean, if there's 8 billion people in the world as of November 2022, that means that we've got 896 million people worldwide that are suffering from a reversible gut health issue.
So IBS, let's zoom in on that and find out what that is.
Irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, is a name given to a constellation of symptoms that are usually associated with feeling abdominal discomfort after eating. Sometimes it leads to having bowel movements, having to run to the bathroom, lots of unpredictability in the bowel movements. It could be IBS-D, which is with diarrhea, or it could be IBS-C with constipation. The problem with that is that all we've done is name the symptoms. We haven't really uncovered the root cause. The root cause could be bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine. Actually, SIBO, which is small intestine bacterial overgrowth, accounts for at least 60% of IBS cases. It could be some sort of post-infectious IBS. The person may not remember when they had the infection, but it can actually lead, and this is something that a lot of people don't know, is that there is a subsegment of IBS that happens after a gastroenteritis that is actually autoimmune. And I bet you've never heard the words IBS and autoimmunity put together, but there is a subsegment of IBS that actually is an autoimmune condition where the body even starts attacking the microfilaments that help keep the cells that line the intestines together. So it leads to leaky gut, but from a different pathway than typical things like wheat, gluten, things like that. And so you can have yeast overgrowth, you can have bacterial overgrowth, you can have food sensitivities. Usually there's leaky gut in the background. And anybody who has IBS will tell you they have a very sensitive stomach most of the time. And there is a very strong brain-gut connection and stress connection with IBS.
Yeah. You speak a lot about stress, and I actually want to address this, because you speak about two types of stress. And for me, okay, when I experience, I would say quote unquote stressed. I think living in New York City, I've adapted to a stressful environment. And not just that, my career and my work has made me from the regular, you know, from, if you look at what stress is, I think that I'm very built to handle that mentally. What I'm not built for, unfortunately, is emotional stress. And not to say that I go through this regularly, but if I do, what tends to happen is my gut or my stomach, it just goes into overdrive. Sometimes I can't eat. I am running to the bathroom, and that's significant for me. And it lasts probably 2-3 up to a week.
Yeah. And that happens to a lot of people. And you talked about the different types of stress, and being someone who lives in New York City now for 24 years, crazy, I know how difficult it can be to live in a city like New York, where there's so much energy. And whether you're not mentally stressed because of work or because of life or personal, professional issues, you're still, sometimes what I tell people, because I get a lot of patients here and I've dealt with so many overachieving, stressed out, type A New Yorkers over the years. But they'll come to my office and they'll say, I'm not stressed. Mm. And I look at them and I say, but you're doing this and you run from meetings and you're inhaling your lunch and then you have work meetings after, and then you only get like 5 to 6 hours of sleep per night. You may not mentally be stressed, but your body is biophysically stressed. And whether you're registering the stress mentally, your body is registering that stress. And you might lie to yourself with the stories that you make in your mind. You might, you know, say, no, I can handle this, I'm fine. And yet your body is breaking down because your body is biophysically stressed. And there's good stress and there's bad stress, right? So I talk about hormetic stressors in the book. Like, for example, things that are becoming really popular now, and I've actually gotten into myself, like cold plunges.
Yeah.
Like taking a cold shower.
Yeah.
You know, just even just a high intensity workout. Mm. All of these things are good stressors.
And we need this, yes.
Yeah, we need that level of challenge. The problem is when you have chronic, unrelenting, ongoing stress, and you're not doing any sort of self-care to help remedy that situation for your body. So when you talk about that you get stressed, you lose your appetite. Well, what's happening? Why is that happening? You're losing vagal tone. Mm. So your vagus nerve is this, I was saying in the book, I call it a telephone wire, and that could be because that I'm dating myself back to the age of the telephones. I don't know that people know that now. I probably should have said a fiber optic cable.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe people would have understood that better, but I kind of wanted to go old school. But it's, you know, it's connecting the brain and your internal organs, not just the gut, your heart, your lungs, everything. And it's giving a read on what's happening in there. The reason that I likened it to an old telephone wire is because if you, I don't know if you remember the age of the telephones, but when you picked up a telephone, there was a dial tone. Mm-hmm. You would hear like a little buzz, like zing, and you know that the phone is working. Well, in the same way, your vagus has a tone. When you get stressed, when you go through emotional heartache, say you go through a breakup, you know, you hear about someone in your family passed away, those types of stress, they can shut down your vagal tone. And when that happens, the vagus is actually that those little pulses that it's sending down to your digestive system are controlling things like stomach acid production, digestive enzyme secretion, stomach emptying, the motility of your small intestine. So everything gets paralyzed and then food just sits like a rock in your stomach or you lose your appetite. And what a lot of people don't realize is that low vagal tone is associated with actually mental health conditions.
Like, yes.
Anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I referenced this in the book. I think we did talk about this. There's a study that was done on people with treatment-resistant depression. And they found that they had low vagal tone. And if they used a vagal stimulation device on these patients who had treatment-resistant depression, that means they had been on multiple drug therapies and none of them were working, 37% of them reverted.
Wow.
And their depression resolved.
Wait, so what is low vagal tone?
It's basically, just think of the vagus nerve is basically like a wire.
Yeah.
A wiring. And it sends impulses. And you're getting impulses going downstream from the brain down to the internal organs.
Always.
All the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a background that's happening. And then 70% of those fibers are actually pointing back up to the brain.
Oh, wow.
And those are getting stimulated in many different ways because the nerve endings of the vagus in the intestine actually have serotonin receptors. And those serotonin receptors can be stimulated by different things. So we have endocrine cells inside our small intestine called enteroendocrine cells that secrete serotonin that then stimulates those vagal nerve endings and sends signals back to the brain. Mm-hmm. But the microbiome also produces serotonin. Serotonin being, you know, we call it the happiness molecule. And I want to mention something here because I think I realize this. I've seen this over and over, like 95% of your serotonin is produced in the gut. Yes. And for people to understand this, that serotonin can't cross the blood-brain barrier. So yes, your happiness molecule is being produced in the gut, but it's not crossing the blood-brain barrier. That's not how it's having its effect.
Wow. I'm so happy you said that. I didn't know that.
It's something that I discovered through my research. And I thought, whoa, nobody's saying this. We just say like, oh, 95%. And you think it's just getting into your bloodstream. Mm-hmm. No, it's stimulating your vagus nerve. And your vagus nerve is then causing neuroplasticity and controlling the activity within the brain by secreting things like excitatory neurotransmitters like glutamate or GABA. And I find the contradictions are so interesting because the same nerve in one location is stimulating the brain, and in another location, it's actually telling things to shut down. Hmm. So we're getting different effects, but the aggregate is you're getting this brain control that is really important for your autonomic nervous system because the vagus is part of that rest and relax and digest part of your nervous system. So this part of the work I do, and I know it's the latter part of the book, but it's one of the parts that excites me the most.
Yeah. And it kind of seems that this is a vicious cycle, because if you get stressed, let's say, you know, in your head, your brain is sending these signals down to the vagus nerve and you're having all of these IBS symptoms, if you will. But then also the bidirectional effect, if you are feeling good and you're not stressed per se mentally, but you eat, let's just say, a high sugar diet, or maybe you have two or three glasses of wine, then you are sending a signal to your brain, shutting off certain chemicals.
Absolutely. And that's the,
that's scary.
I love that you picked up on that, because that's something that's really a more holistic way of looking at things. Mm-hmm. So you realize that the process could start from the brain down to the gut, but then stress makes you have a glass of wine, makes you go for that ice cream, makes you go for those mashed potatoes, you know, makes you go for all the comfort food. And then that comfort food, it may give you a little dopamine hit because of the sugar in the moment, but it's actually crashing your system. It's causing shifts in the gut microbiome that are going to shift towards more unfavorable bacteria. It's going to maybe promote yeast overgrowth. And that just gets you into this vicious cycle, and the person doesn't know the way out.
Yeah.
And yet the way out is always simpler than people think. You know, one, I talk a lot about how to activate the vagus nerve.
Some people find that a bit woo-woo. Is that an actual thing? Because I mean, like, I feel, you know, coming from neurology backgrounds, like if your vagus nerve isn't activated, then you're pretty much dead. So it's always activated. Okay.
No. So let's redefine. So it's not like it's not acting. It's more like what I said before, the vagal tone is low.
Yes.
And you need to pick up that tone.
Okay.
And we've shown that we can do that through vagal nerve stimulation devices, like electrical devices that are put even on the neck. And there's some that are actually FDA approved.
Yes.
And I talk about a particular device in my book, the Gamma Core, which has been approved for migraines. And then there's one called My Health by NES Health. So there's different devices that have been shown to do that. But you've got an incredible machine right here. That can also do that. And even just by adding, and I know it might seem crazy, but having fermented foods in your diet that help improve the diversity of your gut microbiome, that then is going to produce those neurotransmitters like serotonin that can stimulate those vagal nerve endings, helps to reactivate that vagus nerve. And okay, so let me tie this in with a study. So there was a study that's not in the book because it actually came out in, I think it was October of last year, just after I had just sealed the book. The book was done. And they did this in, I want to say it was done in Ireland, but they wanted to look at what happens to a perceived stress score. There's a specific measure called the Cohen's perceived stress score. Mm-hmm. In a cohort of people, if you put them on a specific diet. So they took about 45 people and they split them into two groups. One group was put on a high fiber, high fermented foods diet. And the other group was just told to eat the healthy food pyramid, reducing processed foods, reducing sugar, but they were not given any guidance on having more fiber. So the fiber-rich group was having 6 to 8 servings of fiber, and they were having 2 to 3 servings of fermented foods daily, and the other group wasn't. And so they did a Cohen's perceived stress score before and after a 4-week intervention period with the diet. There was no mental health therapy. All they got was nutrition guidance. There was no other, and they made sure people were not on any sort of anti-anxiety medications.
Were they eating meat as well? Or just?
Yeah.
Okay. So it wasn't just a plant-based.
It wasn't just a plant-based. Okay. It was plant-forward.
Plant-forward. So maybe 70% plants and 30% meat,
yeah.
Fish, poultry. Yep.
Exactly. And the interesting thing is that, so they did they put people on the program. And they also did something really smart. They not only told people to follow the diet, but they asked people to log it so they could track who was most compliant and who was least compliant, because we know that not everyone's going to do everything perfectly. So they could also stratify the intervention group with the diet intervention with the fiber and the fermented foods. And they also had them include grains and see who was most compliant, who was least compliant, and track their stress score based on that. Overall, the intervention group dropped their stress score by 32%.
Wow.
Compared to the placebo group, which was just doing just general dietary advice, but no specific amounts of, you know, eat more fermented foods. Because typically people who are not being told to eat fermented foods are either having zero or having less than a half a cup a day. They're not having a lot. And so the other group dropped by 17%. And between 17 and 32, that's a significant difference. And then they took the group that had dropped the 32% in their stress score, and they looked at, well, who was most compliant? And they found the higher the compliance with the diet, the greater the drop in the stress score.
Wow.
And it's one of the first studies that I see that's looking at things backwards. You know, because we're always, you know, and I talk about this in the book about using breath work and meditation to get you into that parasympathetic rest and digest and relax state. But here they did it backwards and they said, does diet influence through the microbiome what's happening in the brain? And look, it was a small study, but it's the beginning of, I think if we don't ask the question, it doesn't mean the answer doesn't exist. It just means we haven't looked yet.
Yeah. And that's true for many things in science right now. Okay. So what you're saying is, well, I want to talk about diet because there's a huge war right now on Instagram and social media about what is the best diet to feed the gut microbiome. And on the Neuro Experience,
I have my opinions on that.
Yeah. And I'd love to know them. And, you know, for everybody listening, most people come here to listen, to learn about brain health. So I always attack this from an, you know, how can we prevent cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease, et cetera. So I want to talk about that. But before I do, tell me what the harmful effects are of not optimizing your gut health. Like, can they lead to things other than IBS?
Oh my goodness. There's so many, generally we think of the gut as things that are happening here in the gut, but the gut is ground central for your immune system. 70 to 80% of your immune system is all along the gut lining. So the gut becomes the biggest interface through which inflammation can be activated in the body. And that happens through things that we commonly might take because we might need them sometimes, sometimes we don't. Antibiotics that disrupt the gut microbiome.
Yes.
And then they lead to leaky gut. Or taking anti-inflammatory medications that are available over the counter. And so we think, oh, these are benign. I can take them. But if you read this fine print, it says, no, don't take it more than 2 weeks without consulting with your doctor.
Like Advil, for example.
Advil can eat a hole in your stomach if you take it for too long and cause an ulcer. If you take it more than 2 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, you have to be really careful. And depending on the person, also depends on the person's diet. So it's always about the terrain.
Yeah.
The terrain is really important. And so the gut is the foundation upon which we build the house of our health or of our well-being. And the gut is connected to so many other systems, the skin, the brain, the respiratory system, the immune system, our metabolism, our energy. So many things are connected to the gut. And when it comes to the brain, there's so many interconnections with brain health over the years, including risk for dementia and also risk for Alzheimer's, which has been increasing incredibly. Mm-hmm. You know, in the last 20 years, Alzheimer's has gone from being a disease that you were at risk for if you have an APOE4 gene to a disease that you can't explain just by genetic risk.
Yeah.
And so they did a mouse study, and this is really interesting what they do because I think it's a great model for understanding how does the microbiome or what role does the microbiome play. They use germ-free mice. So germ-free mice have no gut microbiome. They're completely blank slate. And a lot of times they use them as a model to study disease. So they used germ-free mice, and then they had mice that were an Alzheimer's disease model, and they build up plaque in their brain, whereas they looked at the germ-free mice, and germ-free mice were not building up amyloid plaque in the brain, which is characteristic of Alzheimer's. And then they did a fecal transplant, where the germ-free mice were exposed to the poop of the mice with Alzheimer's, the Alzheimer's model. And now they acquired the microbiome of these Alzheimer's mice. And guess what happened to their brain?
They built up the plaque.
They built up beta amyloid plaque.
Wow.
So we look at these studies and we see, okay, there's something going
on. Albeit in rat models, like mice models.
Yeah, mice models.
Still, yeah.
It's not humans, no. But it's a model for at least hypothesizing what could be going on with us because we know that there is an aging microbiome.
Yeah.
So your microbiome is not the same throughout the ages.
Yeah.
We acquire, when we're born with no gut microbiome. And then when the baby goes through the vaginal canal, it's the first time they get coated with the vaginal flora, which is the beginning of the education of their immune system and their gut microbiome. Then through touch, they get colonized with skin microbes. And then through breastfeeding, their gut then gets colonized with Bifidobacterium infantis, which becomes one of the most important bacteria early on in development. And then by the age of 3 to 5, they're starting to look more like they have an adult gut microbiome. But that microbiome also ages over time. And we know this because we've looked at the microbiome of centenarians to ask, well, why are they healthy? You know, is there something different about the microbiome of someone who lives to 100 versus someone who's 80 years old and has, you know, 5 different chronic inflammatory degenerative diseases. And the thing is, the commonality is that for centenarians that tend to be healthier and they tend to have this ability to fight off infection better or just resolve inflammation better than someone who did not live to 100, their gut microbiome is of the type that can reduce inflammation. So it's lacking some of those very pro-inflammatory bacteria that we see associated with a lot of disease states, including conditions like depression.
Okay. So I wanted to ask, my mind was just ticking, if you have a C-section, is the baby still getting the gut? Okay.
No.
But that's not too much of a problem, right?
I do think it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So any friend that is pregnant, or for anyone out there listening who has to get a C-section, because sometimes you have to, you know, maybe the placenta's in the wrong place, the cord is in the wrong place, you know, it would be too dangerous to do a vaginal delivery. If you have a very forward-thinking OBGYN, you can ask them to take sterile gauze and put it inside the vaginal canal. And then when the baby is born, you bathe the baby with all of those vaginal secretions. And by doing that, then you're helping to colonize the baby with that vaginal flora, which is a very important first part of their entry into this world. Because if they don't, what they found is that C-section babies then get colonized mostly by skin flora. And that's not as great. And they've also found that C-section babies are going to be more predisposed to asthma, to allergies. And then if you have a C-section and they're bottle fed and they're not breastfed, then they're going to be even more at risk for allergies, asthma, and atopic diseases and immunological dysregulation when they're teenagers or older.
Yeah. Okay. I hope that doesn't rile some people up. I know that when we talk about, subjects like this, especially even breastfeeding, you get a lot of new mothers just...
We've gone through different periods with that, because babies born in the 60s and 70s, doctors were telling them to not breastfeed. That formula was better, but that was a marketing game. And unfortunately, the formula that was available at the time was not great. The good thing about it is that now we've figured out that one of the most important ingredients in breast milk is human milk oligosaccharides, HMOs, and that those HMOs actually act as a prebiotic and help the gut bacteria grow in the baby. So they've actually started creating formulas that include those HMOs.
Yeah.
So they're making better formulas now than we ever did, because we have more knowledge. Mm. But there's still benefits from breastfeeding, because this is crazy. Mm. Bacteria from the gut of the mother translocate to the breast. And then when the baby breastfeeds, they take in those bacteria.
Wow. So breastfeeding is a very good thing.
So if you can breastfeed, and look, it doesn't always work out. My mom wasn't able to breastfeed because she just wasn't making enough milk. And sometimes, you know, I was born in the early 70s. There probably weren't, lactation consultants back then. Yeah. But now we have lactation consultants that can help figure out how to get that breast milk going if it's not really flowing in the beginning. And sometimes it's harder if you had a C-section baby, because the body didn't go through that major oxytocin release that then triggers the lactation response.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of reasons why it might not happen naturally, but you do the best that you can. And I think I get this question a lot from parents is, you know, I was exposed to a lot of antibiotics. What can I do differently for my child to raise them in a way that's going to protect their gut microbiome better? And I had the opportunity to do that with my son. Mm-hmm. My son was barely, I think the first time he was on antibiotics, he was 7 years old. And it was really necessary at mm-hmm. the time. The first 7 years of his life, everything was viral.
Yeah.
And always, you know, I'm a doctor, so I can... So we didn't always have to take him to the pediatrician.
Yeah.
You know, obviously you want to work with an open-minded doctor, but in the last 20 years, we've reversed the recommendations on inner ear infections in children. Mm-hmm. They used to say inner ear infection requires antibiotics. And then they realize, oh, guess what? We were wrong.
Yeah.
Inner ear infection doesn't require antibiotics. They resolve on their own. Meanwhile, all those people took their kids for ear infections over and over, their gut microbiome is getting destroyed. Mm. And then you're just setting them up for problems later in life.
So my mom had to take a course of antibiotics. This was, I think, 3-4 weeks ago. And so I got her, I reminded her, listen, this is going to kill the good microbes. I was trying to explain it to her in the best way that I could, but I got her on a prebiotic as well.
Yeah,
probiotic.
You can do a lot of different things. You can use prebiotic. You can use special probiotic that does not get killed off by the antibiotic. Mm-hmm. And then you do gut restoration post antibiotics. And there are a lot of people, you know, I've seen these questions, people who are being treated for Lyme, people who are on long-term antibiotics. You've got to do things at the same time to help the gut start to rebuild itself, because you're going in and the antibiotic, yes, is life-saving. And if you have a chronic issue, a chronic infection,
diverticulitis.
Yeah, you may need the antibiotic, but you also have to know how to work with it to restore the gut flora.
Okay. So we know that now having a bad gut microbiome is going to eventually lead to disease states, even chronic diseases. So we know that it's bad, and we know that we need to quote unquote optimize for a healthy gut. So let's talk about diet. And I want to get into it. I want to know what your take is on the best diet for a healthy gut. Don't upset me because I'm a meat eater.
Oh, no, I'm not going to upset you. I actually think that the vegan diet can be quite challenging for gut restoration, especially if you take the quiz in my book, the Gut Smart Quiz, and you come out in the severe category, you're going to have a lot of trouble digesting raw vegetables. Your gut just can't handle them. And one thing that I tell people is that if you're in the severe category, the best thing to do is only eat cooked vegetables while you're healing your gut. But ideally, you're also introducing some level of humanely sourced, really good quality animal protein, because there's no other more efficient protein than what you can get from animals. And we need protein for the amino acids that not only create the neurotransmitters for our body, but also that are the building blocks for every single enzyme that runs every single process in our body. Mm-hmm. And sometimes plant fibers are really hard to digest. Now, I want to tie that in also with the fact that our gut microbiome in the West is not that well built to handle a huge load of fiber and plant fiber and plant fibers. And the reason for that is because of all the things we've talked about, the processed foods, antibiotics, over-the-counter medications, even acetaminophen causes alterations in the gut microbiome, birth control pill, alcohol, all of these things are creating guts that are not working the way they should, the way they were intended to over time, because we are these super organisms that we're symbiotic with this gut microbiome. And when I was doing research on my book, and I went out to Africa and spent time with the Hadza, one of the last hunter-gatherers on the planet. And why is this significant? Well, one, 95% of human history, we've been hunter-gatherers. 95%.
That's insane.
I mean, if you think we go back, humans go back like 30,000, maybe even up to 50,000 years. We've been hunter-gatherers for the majority of that history. We're only been domesticating animals and growing, you know, domesticated plants in the last couple of years. Like tomatoes were a wild plant that was discovered in Mexico and then taken back to Europe. And now we think of tomatoes as like akin to Italian cuisine.
Yeah.
But they didn't even exist back in the Roman era.
Wow.
They were this wild plant that was domesticated, and it was actually considered poisonous at first.
Okay.
So they used it as decorative plants initially, and eventually it started becoming part of the cuisine.
Eventually we just started eating it.
We started eating it. But, you know, plants have certain issues that can be problematic, and there's a lot of talk about lectins and the harm that lectins can have on the body, but I think there's two parts to that. One part is, there are certain outer coating things and things that are on seeds like lectins and phytic acid, which are anti-nutrients, and they can even block your own enzymes from acting. But the other side of it is all the gut disruption that's happening and our ability to break down these foods properly. So it has to do with the gut microbiome.
Yeah.
And what's happening there. Because if you look at the diets of centenarians, a lot of them do include either soybeans or lima beans. Like there's a lot of fiber in these diets. So just back to the Hadza. The Hadza, the reason I'm so fascinated with them is they've done studies on their stool. So they've looked at their stool microbiome. But again, why would I even be interested in that? You know, they're the hunter-gatherers. The reason is they have no diabetes. They have no heart disease. They don't get cancer. They don't get brain disease. Mm. They have no dementia.
Irrespective of genetics.
Yeah.
What are they doing?
Genetics is just the foundational blueprint, but it's really the epigenetics that matters. And the epigenetics is being programmed at several levels, from the food you eat and also by the thoughts that you think.
Oh, that's a big one. I mean, we're going to have to unpack that, okay? Because one of my cousins, she's always, you know, I take the medicine in this hardcore Western scientific approach. And she's like, Louisa, what you think becomes, you know, it affects you. And I'm like, does it really? I want to talk about that.
It's one of the chicken or the egg.
Oh, it gets me so mad.
I know I've looked at a lot of research on meditation and how, you know, what's going on up here, again, vagus nerve to gut, and what it does to the gut microbiome. So we can talk about that.
Before we do, I want to ask you about kale. Because, you know, 10 years ago, kale was the superfood. It was everything. Now I'm hearing, don't eat kale. And so I don't know. What's the go with kale?
Kale is really hard to digest raw.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think if you're having kale, you can have it in a blended smoothie, not a big amount, a blended smoothie where the blender has actually done part of the job of breaking down the cell wall and helping digest it. But kale also has anti-nutrients. So probably the best way to eat kale, if you're going to eat kale, is to have it cooked.
Yeah.
And to not have as much as you think you should.
Okay. Then what would you say are the top three vegetables for gut health?
Ooh, that's a really good one. Some of them are spices. You know, I think turmeric is really important. It's anti-inflammatory. It helps regulate the inflammatory cascade. Mm-hmm. And it serves as a prebiotic in the gut. Oh God, there's so many ways that this could be argued in different ways, because I could also say that fermented cabbage is really, really important.
What about just normal cabbage?
For the gut. Yeah, but fermented foods are so important.
I just don't like the taste. I don't know what it is.
You can get ferments in different ways. Okay. So they did a study where they looked at, this was Stanford University, and actually this study is in the book, where they wanted to look at what happens if we take a group of people, put them into two groups, one group on a high fiber diet, and the other group on a high fermented foods diet. And when I say high fiber, again, it was 5 to 8 servings of fiber per day. But what does that mean in grams? People typically are eating around 10, maybe 20 grams of fiber daily. And during the intervention, they had these people increase their fiber intake to 40 plus grams per day. So more than double for some of them of what they were eating daily. And then the fermented foods, they had them go pretty high. They were during the intervention part, so they had a 4-week ramp up, and then they had a 6-week period when they were doing the intervention diet. The fermented group was having 4 to 6 servings of ferments per day, which is quite a bit. It sounds like it a lot.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was through vegetable brine drinks. So they're actually just drinking the fermented juice that comes from fermenting vegetables, but not eating all that quantity. And they were also having yogurt. So they wanted to look at certain measures that are really important: microbial diversity and inflammatory markers. So they were looking at blood inflammatory markers. They were looking at markers of white blood cell activation. So white blood cells get activated by these molecules called cytokines. Mm-hmm. And so they looked at 19 different inflammatory markers in both groups. And they wanted to see who does better, who improves their microbial diversity the most, who drops their inflammatory markers the best. And when I say microbial diversity, what I mean is almost like thinking about the rainbow mm-hmm. of the rainbow of colors, variety of species of organisms inside the gut. What is the opposite of diversity is what happens when you take an antibiotic. Mm-hmm. It cuts down the variety of organisms in your gut. So microbial diversity is what I like to say, the holy grail of health, because it's associated with so many good things that are not just centered in the gut, but they affect the rest of your body. Mm-hmm. And so between the two groups, we hear a lot in functional medicine that fiber is really good. Eat the rainbow. You can get a lot of different fibers.
That's what I'm trying to do.
It's good for your gut and for your brain. And I thought that that would be the group that increases microbial diversity the most, but it wasn't. It was a fermented foods group. They increased microbial diversity the most and dropped 19 inflammatory markers.
But I don't like it. I just have to learn to like it, right?
There's so many different ways. You know, I think even like vegetable brine drinks, like sauerkraut juice, finding a yogurt that you like or a kefir.
I like yogurt,
Yeah, finding other ways that you can incorporate those ferments. There's pickles even. You know, like pickles?
I take it off. Like,
my goodness.
Yeah. Wait, so okay.
You're one of
so
the first people I hear that doesn't like pickles.
I'm crazy. I don't like sushi. I don't, it's very hard to date me.
Now I do want to say, so the study was only 10 weeks long, and then they had people do a washout where they could kind of regulate their own diet for 7 weeks, and then they did the test. And one thing that may be true is that maybe the fiber-rich group needed more time to show changes in microbial diversity. What they did see is that the fiber-rich group, they had it had an effect on immune activation. So it was immunomodulatory for the person, and it was most immunomodulatory. Again, they did what they did in that other study. They broke up the fiber-rich group into high diversity, mid diversity, and low diversity group.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to see, you know, is there something about their baseline microbial diversity that affected how the fiber worked? Fiber worked best in the group with the highest microbial diversity.
Okay.
So again, it brings me back.
Yeah, okay.
It brings me back to what I keep saying, that microbial diversity is key. Mm-hmm. And when you're asking, well, what is the best diet for the microbiome and for gut health? I think it's a combined. It's getting fiber. Mm-hmm. It's getting the right sources of protein. And then it's also getting fermented foods as well.
Okay. So we have to stick to fermented foods.
But Let's just throw a caveat in there, because I had started with the hot sun and I want to go back, because I had brought up the hot sun and the reason that some people in the West, they can't digest raw plants so well. The Hadza eat a very simple diet. They eat tubers, which are like root vegetables that look, they kind of have a very similar characteristic to jicama. They eat wild berries. They're eating baobab fruit from the baobab tree, which is very high in fiber.
What type of fruit is that, though?
It's the fruit that grows on those really beautiful trees in the African plain that you would have seen in The Lion King.
Oh, gosh, that's taking me back.
Yeah. Okay. It's those really beautiful, they're tall trees and they grow out. They grow out like this. And they actually use the baobab fruit and create a paste from it to wean the children off of breast milk when they're weaning them.
Okay.
They create like a porridge. And then they eat small to medium, sometimes larger animals that they go out and hunt. And they also have wild honey. And when they're having honey, they're having everything. The beehive.
So honey's good for you.
Honey is so good
for you. I'm like a bee. Like I love honey, actually. So my family is from Cyprus and I'm going tomorrow. And they've all my aunties are like, we've gotten you honey. I always come back with like 10 jars of honey. I don't get honey in America. I get it there. is a bad.
Bring me back one.
Yeah, I'm gonna bring you back some honey from the farm. Yeah,
please.
But I mean, I have to eat. So these guys are eating not just the honey; they're eating everything.
So I went out hunting and foraging with them.
Wow.
And I don't know how they see these things. They found the root vegetable, which is hidden underground. And so I had a root vegetable that was just dug out of the dirt.
Raw?
Raw.
Yeah.
They just cut it raw right there. And the other thing is, so these honeybees in Africa, they make their hive inside a tree bark, and then they create like a little chimney. The chimney is probably only about an inch, maybe 2 centimeters. I don't know how they spot it. They are incredible. Like, it's just amazing what happens to the human senses when there are no smartphones, when there are no other distractions.
Oh, you're telling me.
They are these incredible trackers. So they cut open the tree bark, and out came the honey with the honeycomb and these really tiny honeybees, because they look like flies, like tiny little flies. They're not like what we normally would think. And then, you know, we don't speak the language, but we're kind of really having so much fun understanding each other through facial expressions, through hand gestures. And they just had me put my hands out and they poured honey, honeycomb, and there were bees mixed in there. And I was like, I can't be rude.
I
had everything.
Wow.
And there's so many nutrients in there that are prebiotic, that are so good for your immune system, that are immunoregulatory. And so their gut microbiome actually has an incredible ability to handle more fiber because of the makeup of their gut microbiome, because they eat 70% of their food is plant-based and 30% is animal-based. Mm-hmm. And that might be a little bit different because the women stay in camp, so they're probably a little more plant-based, mm-hmm, and a little less animal, whereas the men might eat a little more animal meat, a little and a little less plant-based. But it's about 70-30,
okay,
is the mix. And their gut microbiome has certain types of bugs that we don't see in the Western microbiome that are designed to break down plant fibers.
Okay. All I got from that was honey is good and I'm going to keep eating it and I'm going to bring you back a jar from Cyprus.
Oh, I would be so happy.
Okay. I want to switch gears and talk about beauty. It's this new thing that I'm starting to obsess about. I think maybe because I'm getting older and I'm like, oh my gosh. So I touched on, you know, in a few episodes back, I spoke a lot about collagen and hyaluronic acid, but what caught my attention actually, which is why I invited you here today, was you mentioned something about beauty. And I want to talk about the connection between the gut and the way we look and our skin health.
It's so important because, first of all, if you're not pooping every day, it's going to show up in your skin.
And who isn't doing that? Is that population of people?
So many people are constipated. And so many people actually think that it's normal to only go 2 or 3 times per week, to not go daily. And as you know, women more than men tend towards constipation. And some of it has to do with the cycling of estrogen in the body. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how many patients over the years have come in and thought that, oh, it's normal for me to just go once, twice a week. And then they're wondering why they're feeling the way that they feel, because their system is bogged down. They're not detoxing properly. They're getting acne in their face. Mm. They're having hormonal imbalances, because when you don't poop every day, you get hormonal imbalances that are connected to your gut and how your gut processes all the hormone metabolites that are there to get released from your body. But if they stick around in your gut for too long, because you're not pooping regularly enough, then they're going to recirculate like estrogen. So you become estrogen dominant. And then it has all these effects, including the way that it affects your skin.
How about eye health? And the reason I just said that is because I'm looking at you and your sclera, you've got beautiful, bright, white eyes. And have you ever looked at someone and thought, okay, just looking at their eyes, they look maybe unhealthy? Am I touching
absolutely
on anything?
You know, if you've ever seen somebody who drinks a lot, drinks a lot of alcohol, you'll see that their eyes are more bloodshot. Mm-hmm. In Chinese medicine, the sclera connected to the liver. So when the eyes are red, that's a sign. So anybody who's listening to this podcast, look in the mirror and see, are your sclera a bit red? It could be a sign of different things. So it could be that your eyes are dry. And I've suffered from dry eyes because I used to wear contact lenses. And then I had laser surgery, and that can also create some dry eyes. So sometimes in the middle of winter, my eyes will get a little bit reddish, my sclera, because they're just dry. But if it's not that, then the other connection is with the liver. And in Chinese medicine, the whites of the eyes are connected to your liver. So if your sclera, the white part of your eye, has a lot of vascularity, looks red, that's a sign that your liver is bogged down. And basically a sign that your liver is a bit overwhelmed and you need to detox your liver and detox your system.
Okay. Let's touch on a subject now that gets everybody. It's a trigger, and it is alcohol. And I speak about this often, saying that no amount of alcohol is good for the brain. We now have human studies that show the detrimental effects of one glass, two glasses of wine. And in fact, you're now considered a moderate drinker if you're having seven drinks per week. Moderate drinker, seven drinks per week. So that's bad for the brain. But is it bad for the gut?
I like to say that you can't have your drink and fix your gut too.
I like that.
You just can't. Because alcohol, you know, we use alcohol to sterilize surfaces, right? So when you drink, alcohol is actually affecting your gut microbiome. And just like an antibiotic, it's going to wipe out some of the good bugs.
Yeah.
It's going to interfere with that interface, which is so important. What's happening between the bacteria in the mucus layer that's right next to your gut lining and through the gut lining, and cause increase in gut permeability and leaky gut. And then it activates your immune system. It makes your body secrete all sorts of inflammatory signals. And then through that inflammation then leads to more fat deposition in the middle. So people think that alcohol is just liquid calories. It's also inflammatory calories. It's gonna make you gain weight in the middle. I mean, how many people out there, if you just cut out alcohol, if the only thing you did was cut out alcohol, how quickly do you drop about 5 pounds?
Pretty quick.
Just with that.
Yeah.
So I think of alcohol as a major gut disruptor. And if you're going to heal your gut, you can't drink and heal your gut at the same time.
Yeah.
And trust me, I've had those patients who still want to have their glass of wine. They want to follow the diet protocol. They want to take the supplements. And it's like, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't have your drink and heal your gut too.
Yeah.
It's just impossible. If you want to heal your gut, then you've got to cut out alcohol until things are better. You can't have both of them.
No.
And I hate to say that, and hopefully people don't get upset with me, but I just believe in calling things out as they are. And if you want to achieve a certain goal, then there are certain things you have to do in order to achieve that goal. And a big one, I think, is alcohol. And I've actually been experimenting with it because I'm not a big drinker. I wouldn't even come out as a moderate drinker, seven drinks. I would say anywhere between 0 and 4 over the course of 2022 per week. But on January 1st, I woke up and I decided, I'm not going to drink.
Cold turkey.
Cold turkey, yeah. I mean, I just intuitively felt that it was not doing good. And I also felt that, you know, I'm starting to tell people how important it is to heal their gut. And I've done so much gut healing over the years that I was able to start having drinks again. And I was fine, quote unquote, because I even noticed that there's a certain brain effect from having one drink.
Oh, yeah.
One drink the next morning, I could feel it. And when I stopped, I could feel how I shifted even my relationship with the morning, waking up before sunrise, meditating as the sun was rising, going to the gym early in the morning, just completely different things that were harder for me because I'm not always the morning person. Taking the alcohol out made it super easy to become a morning person.
Okay.
And again, I wasn't having a lot. You know, and there's probably a lot of people out there who think, well, I'm just have like, you know, I just have a drink on the weekends with my friends. But sometimes it's not one drink, it's three drinks.
And I want, who goes out on the weekend just has one drink?
You know, you don't have just one drink. But I want you to think about this for everybody who's listening. When you go out and have one, two, three, whatever number of drinks, the next day, I want you to document how your gut feels. Because if you're not paying attention, doesn't mean it's not happening. It's just you're not really paying attention. How does your gut feel the next day? After you, do you have the runs? Do you have a loose stool? You know, all of these are signs of what it's doing to your gut and also through the gut affecting your body systemically.
I love that. I love that so much. It's like really studying yourself. Yeah. Okay. I want to know, in your book, you've got also practical tips on how to have a healthy gut and how to manage stress better. So what would you say are the top two tips that everybody listening right now can start to implement to have a healthier gut other than diet?
Breathing.
But we do that.
Learn how to breathe.
Learn how to breathe properly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Learn how to breathe properly. So can I test you?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it.
Do you have to check like my diaphragm?
Because, no, okay, I'm just gonna watch you. I don't want you to even think too much about it.
Okay.
I'm gonna do what I do with when I have a patient right in front of me. And I tell you, take a deep breath. Okay. So can you tell me what you did?
I breathed in through my nose, yeah. Inhaled, and then I exhaled through my mouth.
Okay. But which part of your body moved?
My chest.
Yes.
Yes.
So when you breathed in, you did this.
Yes.
Which is what most people do because we want to look good. We want to be beautiful. We don't want our belly to stick out. So we've learned to breathe in a way that is actually complete opposite of how we should be breathing because we don't want our belly to pop out. But it should be the opposite. And the most important thing you could learn is how to do deep diaphragmatic breathing. And that's one of the first things that I teach in chapter 10 of my book. And that leads into the breathwork chapter and then the meditation chapter. So everything builds upon itself because you need to know how to breathe in order to do the breathwork. And you need to know how to breathe and do the breath work in order to do the meditations.
Okay.
So they all build upon themselves. So the way you breathe, and I'm gonna do it sitting. It's not always the easiest thing to do sitting. So in my book, I walk people through an exercise where you actually lie on the ground or you lie in your bed with your knees bent because then that relaxes your belly. Mm-hmm. And you put one hand on the belly and one hand on the heart or over the chest. That way, you can close your eyes and then you can tune into what part of your body is moving. Mm. So when you breathe in, the first part that should move is down here, your hand and your yeah. belly. Second part is up here. So when you took a breath, and pretty much everyone, so don't feel bad, because everybody I ask do this, I kind of just asking them so they can fail the test.
Yeah.
So, but then it brings awareness because I think there's such an important learning that happens kinesthetically mm-hmm. when it comes to breathing. If you ever look at a baby when they're about to yell or cry, do you ever see what they do?
No.
They take a deep diaphragmatic breath.
Oh, they do. And they get ready for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're like an opera singer. Yeah. Like oh.
Yeah.
So you put a hand over the belly, a hand over the chest. And then instead, we're going to reverse it and we're going to breathe into the belly. So deep breath in. Second part of the breath is up here. And then you can either breathe out through the mouth. You can even, like if you're stressed, you can purse your lips so you slow down the exhale. Or you breathe out through your nose. You're going to breathe out first from the top and then you're going to push down through your belly, and that's the end of the exhale. So it's, and then we reverse that and inhale again. So you see how my chest...
I feel like you have to practice this.
My chest barely moves. Mm. And I will say that sitting is not the easiest way. Mm. I can do it sitting because I've been practicing this for a long time. But sitting, there's a lot of a lot of feedback going to the brain. When you lie down, it's actually also easier because the other thing that I want people to feel is that your lungs fill up like a barrel. Mm. And so imagine that the bottom of the lungs is expanding and it's expanding in all directions. So as you feel your belly going out, you're also going to feel the back of your ribs going into your bed or into the floor. So you're going to feel this expansion like that. And that's how we should be breathing.
Okay.
And what happens when people get stressed is they go into what I call a shallow breathing pattern. You bring your breathing in. And then you're just chest breathing. So you're kind of doing like that. And you're not breathing with your diaphragm. And I almost think of it as a way to protect yourself. So going back to living in New York, to being, managing the stress. But then if I ask, it's almost 100%. If I ask a New Yorker, take a deep breath. And they go like this. And sometimes they don't get a lot of air.
Yeah.
And what you don't realize is that you're using this part of your body as armor to protect you from the biophysical stress of the environment. And when you feel safe, you can relax and you can take a really deep breath. What happens when you go out to the mountains, when you're out in nature? And you take a breath, you ever feel like that breath is like the freest breath you can ever take?
You feel amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
I love that.
And by doing
that... And that can help like activate the parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah, so what we're doing actually is we're activating those stretch receptors in the lungs, and those stretch receptors are a feedback loop into the parasympathetic nervous system that then activates the parasympathetic, activates the vagus nerve, gets you into more of that rest and digest place. So a very practical thing that people can do who watch this podcast is first practice deep diaphragmatic breathing. And what I tell my patients is do this for 5 minutes and don't even think about it. Just set the timer, lie down, put an eye mask on, really tune in. I don't want you to look through your eyes. I want you to feel into your body, listen to your body and feel where your breath is and practice it because it does take some practice to learn how to reverse that breathing pattern that we've learned to do. And then once you know this, if you're stressed out in the middle of your day, stop and just take 3 deep diaphragmatic breaths and it will change your internal environment in less than 30 seconds.
I'm going to start doing that. It's going to be part of my practice. And this is all in your book?
It's in my book, The Deep Diaphragmatic Breath, then a whole bunch of breathwork exercises. Yeah. I teamed up with several breathwork teachers, as well as meditation teachers. And it's all in the book. We have the holotropic breathwork with Jesse Gross. We have meditation with Emily Fletcher, who's a great meditation teacher. Have a mindfulness practice before, during, and after meals with Amanda Gilbert, who's a mindfulness coach. And then I decided that I was going to write a meditation for my book because we didn't talk about that, but I started meditating when I was 21 years old. I started doing breathwork and meditation when I was 21 in 1995.
Wow. Back when no one was talking about it.
When no one was talking about it. That's when I started it. And so I decided I wanted to include my own meditation. And I took what I've learned as the Tibetan loving kindness meditation, which is a meditation where you give love to yourself. And then you expand that love and you send that love to loved ones. And then eventually you just send the love to the entire earth, to the whole world. And usually I even take it beyond and I send love to the entire universe, to everything. But I decided from my experience working with patients with gut health issues and gut-related health issues, usually they develop this kind of like this antagonistic relationship with their gut, and they feel like I'm bloated all the time. Their gut becomes a problem, not a friend.
Yeah.
And so part of, I think, the path to healing is reframing that relationship with your body, with yourself. And so I created something that I call the gut love meditation.
I love that.
And it's about sending love and gratitude to your gut microbiome,
yeah,
for all the hard work that it does in creating all of these incredible metabolites. We call these postbiotic nutrients that actually help balance your body and keep you fit, keep your blood sugar balanced, and help your brain learn and create memories.
Wow. Dr. Pedro, this has been absolutely incredible. Where can everybody find out more about you, and where can we find your book?
My book is on everywhere where books are sold. They can go to Gut Smart Protocol, GUTSmartProtocol.com. And there's actually some QR codes in the book. Obviously, I'd love for everyone to get the book. But they can also go to the website and they can take the quiz for free, the Gut Smart quiz, to find out what your gut type is. They can check out a free chapter of the book, and they can also, in the resources section of the website, find all the meditations and breath work led by the teachers themselves. So I interviewed everyone.
Okay.
So you can have the actual teacher lead you through the exercise. And there's some bonus ones because the Lee Holden, who is a worldwide Qigong master, I just put the interview with him in the book because I realized that the breathwork exercise really needed to be led by him. Mm-hmm. So instead, you can go to the website and actually do a Qigong exercise that's led by Lee Holden, which is amazing. If you're feeling like your energy is low and you're feeling like the day's been hard on you, if you just take 10 to 15 minutes to do this Qigong exercise with Lee Holden that's on the website, you'll finish it and you'll be revitalized. It's amazing how you can shift your energy so quickly.
Well, we're going to link everything below in the show notes. Thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast.
And of course, I forgot to say on Instagram, at Dr. Pedre.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.